If it is so inadequate, why in the blazes did they release it? Why in the blazes are they working towards enacting it?
Frustration over the Air Force report on the proposed F-16 move from Eielson. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a plan to resume oil storage near Mount Redoubt.
Putting oil at the base of an active volcano is really playing Russian roulette with cook inlet fisheries.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
A group of community leaders held a teleconference with the Air Force Director of Logistics to find out more about the proposed relocation of the F-16 squadron at Eielson Air Force Base. The meeting followed the release of an Air Force report revealing more details about the move. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, more than 30 people took part in the meeting, but few of them found any clarity.
Brigadier General and Air Force Director of Logistics Mark McLeod hosted a teleconference to walk more than 30 people through the Air Force's Site Activation Task Force, or SATAF, report. The document outlines costs and savings associated with relocating a squadron of F-16s from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. General McLeod says the Air Force has a responsibility to trim their budget, but the move is still dependent on how Congress influences military spending over the next year.
We are on a course to still be committed to the FY13 president's budget. The broadened task is the realization that Congress has the ability through marks, through appropriations, to influence that. And we're not presupposing one or the other in this process.
Congress hasn't yet passed the bill that will fund the military for fiscal year 2013. The Air Force estimates the relocation will cost at least $5.65 million. An hour in, Senator Mark Begich joined the meeting.
When you save money, that's one thing, but now it's going to cost in the 2013 budget. Where's that money? Because that's not budgeted. And I can tell you, I just finished the defense authorization bill. My understanding is the Defense Department's pretty tight on the budget, so $5.6 million is in pocket change, and that has to show up somewhere.
According to the report, equipment is scheduled to start moving south in the first quarter of fiscal year 2013. That starts October 1st. North Pole Mayor Doug Isaacson says he's heard rumors that airmen at Eielson have already received orders to relocate.
I was with a realtor yesterday afternoon who the BlackBerry started going off, and several realtors were communicating all at one time about orders that people had come into their office, people were contacting them, and they had received orders.
General McLeod couldn't say for sure if orders had been issued.
I don't believe that we are issuing any kind of official guidance on this. I would be shocked, as a matter of fact, if that were the case.
In an email, the Air Force confirmed orders had not been issued. Mayor Isaacson says a combination of rumors, inaccuracies, and what General McLeod called inadequacies in the report could cause undue panic for residents in the Fairbanks North Star borough. He says he's frustrated that the timeline for the proposal remains unclear.
If it is so inadequate, why in the blazes did they release it? Why in the blazes are they working towards enacting it?
General McLeod says it's still too early to tell if the plan will move forward. He says the Air Force is headed down parallel paths.
We are trying to make the plans such that we can execute that with the if clause. If this is the thing that is approved and appropriated through Congress, then it executes. In the event we are able to advise all our senior leaders to the point where they're completely satisfied that the right decisions are being made based on the right information being portrayed to them, then that decision facilitates the Air Force's execution. Does that make sense?
Most of the faces around the conference table seemed both confused and unsatisfied. General McLeod promised to provide answers to all of their questions. The group plans to meet with the general again next Friday. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
After buying the legacy assets of Chevron in Cook Inlet, Hilcorp Alaska is moving forward with plans to increase energy production in several fields there. Part of that plan includes reopening the Drift River Terminal Storage Facility at the base of Mount Redoubt on the west side of Cook Inlet. But as KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, an eruption of Redoubt in 2009 has many wondering about the wisdom of that plan.
Putting oil at the base of an active volcano is really playing Russian roulette with Cook Inlet fisheries.
That was Bob Shavelson, spokesperson for Cook Inlet Keeper and a vocal opponent of Hilcorp's plan to resume storage operations at Drift River. While the 2009 eruption didn't cause a spill at the site, it did highlight the challenges of dealing with potential disasters in that remote area and the shortcomings of the original plan.
When the eruption occurred in 2009, they evacuated the facility. So there was absolutely no way that they could respond because you can't send people into an active volcano zone and expect them to implement any type of reasonable spill response plan.
But that was then. Hilcorp Alaska spokesperson Lori Nelson says after the events in 2009, Chevron was given a laundry list of improvements to be made and concerns to be addressed by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Among these was an engineering report from the original designer of the flood control system.
We've also integrated an in-depth volcano response plan to the contingency plan. New response planning standards based on expected storage capacity were established and also submitted with the revised oil discharge prevention and contingency plan, which we commonly refer to as the C plan, as well as up-to-date tank inspections and some other facility improvements.
Hilcorp has filed an application with the state for a renewal of the spill prevention plan for the Drift River Terminal and the 42 miles of pipeline that feed into it. The four tanks that would be used can each hold 270,000 barrels of oil. Right now, those tanks are protected by an armored berm that runs around the backside of the tanks and along one side of the facility. Nelson says that berm will be enhanced and a new protection system will be added for the four tanks.
That will be a combination of earthen dike as well as dike fortified by sheet pile to make sure that these berms are strong enough to withstand forces well beyond any typical serpent stance.
Given the potential for natural disasters in the area, a better solution might be to simply construct a pipeline and remove the storage facility from the equation altogether. But Nelson says that's not an option at this time.
Although we do recognize that it's definitely the way to go, to make an immediate impact and to solve our immediate needs for production and to avoid shut-in, Drift River is just the quickest solution for us to do that.
Well, the argument we always get from industry, and we're hearing it from Hilcorp, is that we can't afford to do the right thing. It's not cost-effective. We're seeing the same thing here. So at some point, we have to hold industry accountable. Hilcorp is the third largest privately held oil and gas company in the United States. You'd think that they'd have the financial wherewithal to treat the fisheries in Cook Inlet with some respect.
Nelson says she understands the concern about the placement of the storage facility, but also says that operating in geologically active areas in Alaska is almost inevitable.
I feel at this point we've done the research and our homework necessary to make sure that we're doing this safely and hope that Mother Nature cooperates in the long run.
The permitting process for Hilcorp has not yet been finalized. The public has until June 4th to submit their comments to the Department of Environmental Conservation. You can do so and view application materials at their website, dec.alaska.gov. From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The family of a teenager that drowned at a Haines beach 2 years ago is suing the Haines Borough for a wrongful death and asking for at least $1 million in damages. 14-year-old Andrew Williamson died in May 2010 while swimming in Lynn Canal waters near the borough's Port Chilkoot dock. From Member Station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer reports.
The suit was filed last week in Juneau Superior Court by Andrew's parents, Larry and Chetra Williamson, who now live in Florida. Andrew was their only child. The couple's Juneau attorney, in court documents, levels charges of negligence, wrongful death, and emotional distress against the borough. The suit claims the borough knew swimming was common at the beach, but failed to make the area safe for visitors. The complaint says there are no warning signs posted at the beach or near the dock, no lifeguard on duty, and no life-saving equipment like a life ring in the area. The suit says the borough had a duty to warn beachgoers of the seawater's low temperature and the dangers associated with jumping off the dock and nearby mooring float. According to police, Williamson was one of many people at the beach on the warm May afternoon. He and two classmates set out from the beach to swim to the mooring float, a distance of about 250 feet. One of the teens made it to the float, but the other two turned around about halfway. The boy swimming with Williamson said he saw him struggling. One of the boys called out for help. Then Williamson slipped beneath the surface. Other swimmers and people on shore immediately began searching for Williamson. Alaska State Trooper and Harbor skiffs arrived within minutes. A diver located Williamson a short time later, and he was transported to the local clinic where he was pronounced dead.
That report was from KHNS reporter Margaret Friednauer in Haines. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans join in on the new national pastime.
The whole idea of birding changed from bird watching to birding. And birding is more competitive.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The salmon season has started in the Kuskokwim River area with the first Chinook salmon caught near Quinnahock yesterday. Over the past 2 years, the Kuskokwim River has experienced the lowest king salmon numbers in history. As Angela Denning Barnes reports from Bethel, there could be more restrictions on subsistence fishing this year.
State and federal managers came up with their relative predictions of the run's strength and subsistence needs. They are predicting a below-average run of approximately 197,000 king salmon and a subsistence need of about 75,000 king salmon. However, state and federal managers have not yet agreed on how many king salmon they see as needing to escape this year for spawning. State managers initially wanted at least 87,000 for escapement, while federal managers said they needed 133,000 kings to escape. Yukon Delta National Wildlife Manager Gene Peltola Jr. said they sought the higher number to make sure the lower tributaries like the Queethuk River got better numbers this year. Both sides said they would work on a compromise.
At this point, we have not reached consensus with Fish and Wildlife Service.
Travis Ellison is Fish and Game's acting area manager for commercial fisheries.
And for that reason, we want to continue to work with them to try to come to an agreement. We feel we still have some time before any actions need to be taken, no matter what road we decide to take.
Depending on what they decide for the escapement number will affect whether there are subsistence fishing restrictions on the main stem of the Kuskokwim. Managers could implement what is called roll enclosures, which would close fishing starting in the lower river and then moving up toward the headwaters following the King Run. To help manage the stock this year, the Kuskokwim Salmon Management Working Group met Wednesday morning in Bethel. The group includes representatives up and down the river from subsistence users to commercial and sport fishers. Working group member Evelyn Thomas of Crooked Creek said she was opposed to any subsistence restrictions.
I just object to any subsistence closures because up here we don't have employment such as the bigger villages do in the lower Kuskokwim or the pollock fishery out in the ocean. We would have to have other ways of feeding our families this winter.
Subsistence fishing restrictions for kings have already been announced for tributaries including the George, Aniak, Tuluksac, Keezeralla, Kasigluk, and Queethuk Rivers and the Kuskokwak Slough. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The city of Sitka supports efforts to reduce halibut wasted in Alaska's trawl fisheries. The Sitka Assembly approved asking the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to lower the cap on trawl bycatch. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The cap on bycatch for Gulf trawlers has been in place since 1989. It's just over 5 million pounds of halibut per year. Bycatch is the unintentional harvest of another species in a commercial fishery. In this case, trawlers are dragging nets on the ocean bottom for species like pollock and catching quite a few halibut along the way. Those halibut have to be discarded. This presents a problem for the hook and line fishermen who make their living catching halibut. The trawl bycatch used to be a much smaller proportion of the overall amount of halibut caught by commercial fishermen. According to Linda Benkin with the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, It's not so small anymore.
At this point, the number of halibut that are killed as bycatch on a coastwide basis is equal to the number of halibut that's taken in the directed fishery, in the commercial longline fishery.
Behnken was soliciting the support of the Sitka Assembly, who, though Sitka is home to a large longline fleet, has not often taken a position on federal management issues. Halibut stocks have undergone steep declines over the last few years. Cuts to harvest levels in southeast Alaska have been particularly painful.
We've seen a 75% reduction in the commercial catch limits to allow the stocks to rebuild. There's been a 34% reduction in the allocation for the charter fleet, also to take pressure off the stocks. We hear from sport and subsistence fishermen that they're having difficulty meeting their needs. And over this same time period, there's been no reduction in this bycatch limit.
Behnken served three terms on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, where she was no stranger to conflict with the trawl fisheries. She was a key player in banning trawlers from southeast waters. She found plenty of support on the Sitka Assembly.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to find any love lost between anybody in Sitka and the trawl fleet.
Tor Christensen is an assembly member.
Biomass fisheries are dirty. I mean, to me, there's not much difference between a floating monofilament gillnet and a trawler.
Behnken told the assembly that it had been a long battle, but the council was finally ready to consider cutting the halibut bycatch limit in the Gulf of Alaska by three possible amounts, 5, 10, or 15%. Behnken said she thought the cuts should be much deeper, but the trawl fleet was pushing back, arguing that they had not been given the management tools to make significant reductions in bycatch without harming their capacity to fish economically. There are 47 trawlers in the Gulf, many based in Kodiak. There are 1,400 longliners. The economic impact of the declines in halibut stocks and harvests has been widely felt in Southeast. Again, Tor Christensen captured the mood of the assembly.
Yeah, I strongly support this, and I say if there's anything we can do to try and push it below 15%, because I know that the commercial catch has been cut a whole lot more than 15%.
The assembly resolution, which was sponsored by Mim McConnell and Phyllis Hackett, urges the council to take meaningful action now by reducing Gulf of Alaska halibut bycatch by at least 15%. The vote went quickly for a group that sometimes has trouble finding consensus. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council will take up the issue at its meeting in Kodiak on June 6th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Constance Huff. This week on AK, birding. May and June are some of the best months to go birding in Alaska, and the city of Anchorage is no exception. There are hundreds of different birds to spot, and no limit to the characters you'll find watching them. APRN's Dave Waldron is not a birder, but on a recent spring morning, he found his way into the flock.
And we're very excited that you all got up with us bright and early this morning to come out.
It's a beautiful but brisk Anchorage morning at the Campbell Creek Science Center, where a group of 30 or so people have gathered for some birding. The center offers free birding tours throughout the month of May. The crew quickly divides us into groups and introduces us to our tour guides. Yes, that's a human making that noise. Aaron Bowman is our guide today and is a member of the Anchorage Audubon Society, a local birding group.
Sounds more like a red squirrel.
What's that one?
Bullheaded shrike in Japan.
Aaron is an avid birder. Along with being able to do some neat bird songs, he keeps a fairly detailed list of the birds he spots.
I am somewhat of a lister. Every year I do kind of have little goals. Like this year I want to see a Lapland longspur in Anchorage.
Aaron hasn't found a Lapland longspur yet, but he feels pretty good about his progress.
For Alaska, I've done pretty well so far. I got the bristle-thighed curlew. That was one bird that I got actually just last week that I saw.
I'm curious about what birds we might spot on our tour today. It's not long before we're headed down a long gravelly path looking for our first birds of the morning, but we hear them long before we see them.
There's the varied thrush again. Varied thrush usually has two pitches. We'll have a lower pitch, then higher pitch. Kind of sounds like a whistle, or sometimes like a telephone ringing.
Shortly after, we spot one of the varied thrushes perched atop a birch tree. Aaron sets up his large spotting scope with impressive speed, and in no time, he has the bird in focus and ready for the group to view.
Does anyone else want to? It's kind of settled down a little bit if anyone wants to look through here.
Okay, varied thrush, check. Only 492 Alaska birds to go. As the tour continues, I get to know some of my fellow birders. I have to be honest, I expected them to be a lot like the creatures they spent their time watching. Elusive, timid. I was wrong.
I really like birds that eat meat.
That's Mr. Whitekeys, somewhat of a celebrity in Anchorage for his long-running musical, The Whale Fat Follies. I quickly discover he's quite the birder, offering me a free history lesson.
Well, it was sometime back in the 70s that the whole idea of birding changed from bird watching to birding. And birding is more competitive. Birding is running around trying to find every species you can, going out and, keeping every list that you can. I mean, I've known guys who have lists of birds they've seen on TV that they can identify something flying behind the president when he's making a speech on the White House lawn.
And he has a specialized list of his own.
I personally believe that I hold the record for the number of species seen while riding in a Stanley steamer.
After our tour, I'm introduced to Serena Brownlee, the guide for the other group this morning. When I tell her my typical birder stereotype has been shattered, she says that's pretty normal.
Well, a lot of people think birders are older and, kind of not as personable. But I think a lot of young people are getting into birding.
Brownlee also thinks birding is growing in popularity in general. She's seeing more people not just bird watching, but attending bird festivals and special events. Brownlee has a simple explanation for the trend.
Birds are accessible to everyone, especially if you start to learn some of the songs. You can have an idea what's going on in your own backyard or wherever you go on a walk without having to take a lot of equipment. And, birding is the number one pastime in the United States, according to some polls.
Sounds believable to me. After all, just last year, a major motion picture with an all-star cast was made on the subject. The movie, titled The Big Year, stars Jack Black, Owen Wilson, and Steve Martin.
How you doing, Stu? Still filling those weekends, I see. Unless you and your son here are doing a big year.
Kenny Bostick, this is my friend, Brad Harris, who's also not doing a big year.
Big-footed goose! Big-footed goose, other end of the boardwalk!
I can't be certain if the movie has attracted more people to the pastime, but back at the Campbell Creek Science Center, I'm beginning to warm up to this whole birding thing. Perhaps it won't be long before I'm marking the bristle-thighed curlew off my own list. And even if I don't, Mr. Whitekeys says it will still be worth it.
What else are you going to be doing at 6:30 in the morning?
For AK, I'm Dave Waldron.
It's time again for 300 Villages, AK's weekly trip around the state. What community do marathon runners, dog mushers, and railroad buffs have in common? If you guessed Seward, you're right. The city is located at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula on beautiful Resurrection Bay, and today Seward celebrates its 100th birthday.
I'm Patty Linville, and I'm the librarian here in Seward. Actually, Seward was founded by John Belaine. His whole reason for being here was to build a railroad into the interior, and Seward become the gateway to Alaska. He worked on it for, 4 or 5 years, and then he wasn't successful. And then later, I think it was in 1912 or 13, that they started up again, and I think it was the Alaska Railway Company was successful in getting the railroad into Anchorage and Fairbanks. The Iditarod Trail just had their centennial as well, It started here, and they went to Iditarod for the gold during the gold rush days. And they pushed the trail through initially, and then it was used quite heavily, I understand, during the gold rush. And actually, the people in Iditarod called it the Seward Trail. Yes, the Mount Marathon, and that's a really fun. If you haven't been there, you really need to check it out. Many, many people come to town, and you get to watch all the runners go from the center of downtown all the way up to the top of a 3,000-foot mountain and back. And the front runners are really fun to watch, and also the people who are coming in at the back there. It's a really quintessential 4th of July celebration. We still get the cruise ships, and also the Sea Life Center is a real draw for people to come down and see that. We have Woody the sea lion, who he's an elder there at the Sea Life Center. and then that's where a lot of rescued animals go when they're found. They take care of them there. This Friday, we're having a council reunion, a city council reunion. We've invited people who have either been on council, served on council, people who ran for council and didn't get it. And we have some trivia that we're going to go through and just kind of have a community get together and celebrate the fact that we've been incorporated for 100 years.
That was Patty Lindvall, Seward librarian. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron, Annie Feit, and Ellen Lockyer. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Constance Huff.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Constance Huff was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.